You're listening to the Shared Security Show, exploring the trust you put in people and technology with your hosts, Tom Esten, Scott Wright, and Kevin Johnson. Today's podcast is brought to you by NordLayer. NordLayer safeguards your company's network, but it's much more than just a VPN for business. It secures and protects remote workforces as well as business data and can even help you ensure security compliance. Most modern businesses are adopting network solutions like SASE, Zero Trust, and hybrid work security. NordLayer has all of that and more. Don't leave your business vulnerable. Try NordLayer today. Get your first month free by going to nordlayer.com/sharedsecurity. That's nordlayer.com/sharedsecurity to get 1 month free. Welcome to episode 251 of the Shared Security Show. And joining me this week are the fabulous co-host duo of Kevin Johnson and Scott Wright. Welcome back, my fantastic duo. And we are also joined by very special guest, Matt Shearer, host of the Threat Reel podcast and incident response superstar. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here. I appreciate the invitation.
Yeah, man. So we've been kind of running into each other at conferences, right? And just saw you a couple weeks ago at the Information Security Forum in Cleveland. And I was actually looking up some of your past talks. You did one called Becoming an IR Superstar. And I was kind of impressed that you used Hangar 18 by Megadeth to introduce yourself.
Yeah, that particular talk was in Dayton, Ohio. So for anybody that is listening that isn't familiar with Ohio lore, don't believe Hollywood. They get it wrong with Independence Day. No, Hangar 18 was never rumored to be or purported to be in Area 51. It's Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. So every time I go to Dayton, Ohio, I just feel the need to crank up Megadeth's Hangar 18, especially since I'm right side of the outside the Air Force base. And, you know, I figure I'm streaming it through the Bluetooth in my car. So, you know, it probably gives them something fun, different to surveil.
I love it. I love it. And who knows if there's actual aliens at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. There might be. You never know.
Yeah, I'll let people do their own research and draw their own conclusions.
That's a great answer. Great answer. So we have Matt on the show today, and we wanted to talk about incident response and digital forensics. Very interesting topic. And specifically, we're kind of bringing back our series on how to break into the cybersecurity industry. And in particular, we wanted to talk to Matt about this really interesting field of digital forensics and incident response. And you know a little bit about that, I think, Matt. That's been your entire career. So maybe for our audience, can you give us a little bit about your background and kind of what you're currently doing?
Sure, I'd love to. So I've talked a lot of places about my interest in information security and just how far back that goes. I don't want to rehash that story. So let me talk about something I've never really talked about, which is really how I got interested in digital forensics and incident response. So I paid a lot of dues to get to an opportunity in information security. That was seriously, it was a 20-year journey. Along the way, I did a lot of things, including systems administration. And so, you know, sysadmin, server admin, network admin stuff, all of it, dabbled in storage. I've had my hands in a lot of different technologies in enterprise environments. I actually worked for a company that did web hosting. And so on the systems team, they asked me, hey, why don't you take the system, the hosting stuff, and just kind of run with it and run that here. And so, you know, we kind of divvied up responsibilities and, you know, that company I was working with, it was a small to medium-ish size company, but, you know, they had their hands in a lot of different things. And so it was very eye-opening. And one thing I got to do is email administration. So within that environment, things like Microsoft Exchange, SendMail, and QMail were things I would administer as part of that. And, you know, Postfix was around. We didn't really have it in the environment, but the other three I got to work with a lot. And so I got very good at working against or sort of combating email attacks of all kinds. And in a lot of ways, those were simpler, more innocent times, even as nefarious as they were, because usually what the threat actors were trying to do were like website defacements, putting in PHP mailers to blast out spam campaigns. You know, this was sort of really before ransomware took off and, you know, a lot of these, you know, more monetizing type of activities. And so really that was, you know, got me into email security, but we also had web servers and we had IIS and Apache and, you know, a hosting platform, supported a lot of different things. Our internal developers there, where I was working at the time, were, you know, did a lot of stuff in WordPress, but they were genuine developers. Like they could actually code. And so they would use very few themes, plugins, a lot of those kinds of things that give WordPress such a bad reputation. So it was almost never their sites that got compromised, but we had a lot of self-managed or third-party managed things. And you find out quickly that a lot of so-called developers really are just people that throw a lot of themes and plugins, do a lot of cool stuff, and you know it, but they don't really have any of the coding. So it and of course that increases the attack surface, right? Because if you have 10 plugins on a site and these are all community developed, let's say 20% of them might have a vulnerability. Well, now all of a sudden, instead of having, you know, 2-3 plugins on a site, if you have 10, you know, and the more that get added, the bigger the attack surface gets. And so we would have third-party websites get popped. And usually I wouldn't know until we would find like rate limitation triggers going off in our spam firewall. And so I got really good at doing hacked website forensics. And then I started gauging how good threat actors were, and I would have fun with it. So one of the things, like, for example, I would see WordPress attacks against a website that wasn't even a WordPress site. And so I started kind of messing with the bad guys as much as I could. Now, if they were directly attacking, so what I would do is I would redirect their requests back to the loopback 127.0.0.1. And so the harder they thought they were hitting us, the harder they were actually hitting themselves. Or if it was part of a zombie botnet, my hope was that it would send some sort of trigger, it'd finally get somebody's attention wherever that remote server was, and maybe make them think, why is this system now overtaxed? Why is our network slowed down? Those kind of things. So they would maybe take a look and actually fix the problem. And so I was doing all this kinds of stuff. And then it was funny because I remember when Brian Krebs was getting heavily DDoSed once, you know, he decided to point his web host back to the loopback. And now if you're Brian Krebs and, you know, world renowned, well read, you know, you got lauded and, you know, if you're Matt Shear, lowly systems administrator at the time in a hosting company that most people have never heard of, you know, I was doing this stuff and, you know, I wasn't really telling anybody, but I got no praise or recognition for it. But yeah, I was absolutely doing that kind of stuff just to kind of, and it's funny because that eventually became a talk called Active Defense, Helping Threat Actors Hack Themselves, where I put in a lot of these ploys, no understanding how threat actors worked and the techniques they would use, and try to kind of turn that around and, you know, turn it against them.
That's awesome.
That's really cool. So, it sounds like you started, you know, doing sysadmin work. You know, I think a lot of us got started in the industry that way. How did your career in digital forensics kind of progress from that point? Like, what was your first big break in the industry?
Yeah, so from there, it was interesting. I had a lot of recruiters sort of reaching out to me. It interviewed one place, and I would go to a meetup group, a local meetup group called the SIMPA Security SIG, and I got to know the organizer of that pretty well. and he was basically the VP of security at First Financial Bank, which is based in Cincinnati. And it was funny because during one of those meetings, it kind of wrapped up. There were a few of us hanging around, just kind of bantering back and forth and shooting the breeze. And I just happened to mention, hey, by the way, I have an interview tomorrow, so wish me luck. And by that point, I had spoken at DerbyCon 5. It was my first time speaking at a conference, and that got a lot of attention. And Brad asked me, said, well, hey, if you could have any job doing what you want, what would you like to do? And I told him I'd really love to get into a security analyst, security engineer type of role. Where I found myself in was wearing all kinds of hats for anything to do with security. And it might be next generation firewalls and pushing out policies to doing vulnerability management and then, sort of running scans and then manually validating, doing AppSec stuff to figure out, are these findings legitimate or are they false positives? And then, sort of looking at DLP things, answering auditor questions. I just really ran the gambit, but incident response was maybe about 5% of my job there. But I think since I'd cut my teeth kind of doing that in a hosting company, it was my favorite 5%. And about 4.5 years later, I find myself in my current day job. I can't really talk about where that is now, but and so really it was, I was looking for something that was, sort of upper echelons, incident response, principal engineer level job. And I found a great opportunity for that. I've been doing that, focused specifically on that for more than 2.5 years now. And, nice. All that hard work and just continue to improve really paid off and paved the way for where I am today.
Employee awareness of cybersecurity threats is critical to your organization, but most employees are bored by traditional security awareness training. The vast majority of employees are much more engaged when training is gamified. ClickArmor is the first fully gamified security awareness platform that reduces employee vulnerability by 60%. These days, we can't avoid cyber threats. They're everywhere, and everyone is a target. Employees really need to get better at avoiding cyber threats, like phishing and social engineering. Most security awareness training solutions aren't effective enough to really change behavior. ClickArmor uses a very different approach that employees love. We use proven gamification techniques with psychological drivers that keep employees motivated to learn and improve their skills. Rather than using controversial live phishing tests that anger many employees and provide unreliable metrics, ClickArmor's unique learning challenges help employees learn about cybersecurity in a fun, stress-free way that builds up their confidence. And our engaging simulated threat scenarios motivate employees to improve their skills in a safe and fun environment. Gamified simulators can also extend far beyond phishing scenarios to practice facing dangerous social engineering scams. Our weekly 3-minute challenges provide continuous reinforcement for employees. Motivating employees to participate willingly means higher assurance reporting for compliance and risk management. Simple integration with your employee directory means that deployment of ClickArmor is a snap, and single sign-on makes usage and ongoing management of ClickArmor easy. ClickArmor has been proven to provide better employee engagement, making IT managers' lives easier. If you're tired of ineffective awareness training that hurts your corporate culture, find out how to gamify your security awareness training experience to improve employee resilience with ClickArmor.
What kind of advice do you have for people that are new to the industry, or maybe, they're in college or even thinking about going into college and they want to have a career in digital forensics and incident response? What's the best advice you would give them?
Sure. It's underrepresented, in my opinion, in schools. We're very keen to push offensive security, and with the goal of, hey, be a pen tester, be a red teamer.
That's the sexy
side,
right?
Those positions open, honestly.
Yeah.
What I love about incident response is those skills do not go to waste. If you have offensive security skills, consider going into incident response because you understand the tools people are using, how they work, why they're used, and more importantly, start understanding the artifacts they leave behind. You can actually gauge the sophistication level of an attacker based on what you're seeing in logs or packet captures in a lot of cases. And a real quick example is if somebody's trying a traversal attack and they're coming from one IP address, they're targeting a single destination IP address in your environment. And one log line, you see they're trying to do a traversal to dump out the win.ini file. A couple log lines later, you see they're trying a traversal attack for /etc/passwd. Now, one of those might work against a Windows system. One might work against the Linux system. You're not going to have a destination host that's going to, or both of those have any chance of working. But yeah, for people that are looking to get into it, so there's a couple things. If you go out to slides.dfirmat.com, you can get to my, that'll redirect you to my GitHub repository. I have slide decks out there for becoming an IR superstar and also a talk called Lemme Your IRs. It has a lot of great stuff in there. One is particularly becoming an IR superstar, really is to sort of go out there and evangelize incident response because it's not getting that attention. But we're also not doing a good job as an industry of explaining to people, here are the baseline technical skills that you want to have, and here's where you should focus your learning path on. So I think I really put that talk together to help those kinds of folks. There's some other great resources out there. So the ANISA training labs are put out by the European Union, and they are absolutely free. The VMs are there, the lab guides, you know, the workbook, the instructor guide, the virtual machine image, which does not require much resources. You can run it on a relatively low-powered system with, you know, VirtualBox, for example. Those are really good exercises. Now, there's some caveats. It's European Union, so the English is international English, so things might be spelled differently than we're accustomed to here in the United States.
Okay, I can read it.
Yeah, he's Canadian, yeah. So he's
oh,
fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
And yeah, and there's some other things like the time zones are a little bit different. They talk about a lot of legal stuff. Mm. Laws in Europe aren't necessarily the same as they are in the United States. So you always have to take those things with a grain of salt. There might be a lot of overlap, but there are definitely differences. So you just some things to be aware of when you go through them, but they are really awesome exercises. So if you start doing those things, another resource, get used to doing packet capture stuff and looking at packets. If you go to workshops.dfirmat.com, I have a couple workshops out there, really good stuff for incident responders or aspiring incident responders. The two that I have out there are Cyber Chef, which is an awesome free web app tool that you can do a lot of cool digital forensic stuff with, and a lot of file analysis. And you can do all kinds of stuff with Cyber Chef. They call it the Cyber Swiss Army Knife, but it does a ton. And also I have a Wireshark workshop and these are 2-hour workshops. You just download a very small zip file, extract it. The text files in there are the lab guides, literally step by step by step. We'll step people through everything they need to do for those workshops. So there's some resources, hopefully inspire some aspiring incident responders out there.
So let's maybe switch gears a little bit and just talk about, like, you know, what do you think the future holds for digital forensic and incident response? I mean, obviously, right, there's data breaches and hacking that's still continuing. I would argue that it's probably increasing, right? It's all good job security for all of us, no matter what side you're on. But what do you think about the future of this career path?
Sure. I think the future sort of follows where the technology is going. So some of the things that are here today and they're only growing in popularity are like containerization. So thinking of things like Docker, Kubernetes, those things are becoming more and more popular as things are, because the world's becoming a little more, and IT is becoming a little more elastic and things are very much on demand, as needed, when needed, sort of thing. So understanding how to investigate those is becoming more and more important. Also, because there are so many SaaS solutions, cloud. Let me run back to cloud in a minute. But you know, when you start looking at software as a service type applications, people need access to their data. But since it's no longer in their on-prem environments, the way that typically happens are through APIs. And so API security and understanding how to investigate potential API attacks and also making sure that you have the monitoring and the controls in place to be able to analyze attacks against those resources is, again, increasingly important. And then just really as things transition more and more to the cloud, it's really becoming important to, you know, sort of make sure that you know how to do incident response within cloud environments. And there's some pretty cool stuff. So, you know, Microsoft has all sorts of stuff for, you know, learning Sentinel and KQL, a lot of it free. I have a friend, Matt Coons, who's at Arbor Networks on Twitter. He has a open source project called CAFIR, C-A-F-I-R, and that is for automated incident response in the Google Cloud environment. And, you know, obviously with AWS, you want to make sure make sure you have your flow logs working, make sure that you understand how to look at guard duty for, you know, those kinds of alerts, and make sure that you understand, you know, CloudTrail and being able to see those logs, understand what's happening there. So yeah, really as things have moved to the cloud, even getting into mail services, it used to be, I had to either have directly on-prem access to send out email, or you had to at least VPN into your infrastructure. As things have moved to Microsoft and Google Mail for, you know, cloud services, now all of a sudden those things are accessible anywhere on the internet. So again, the attack surface sort of goes up. There's some advantages to, you know, migrating to those services for sure, which is why organizations are doing it. But it does open up, you know, that attack surface in ways that didn't exist in the past.
Yeah, I think that's a big trend that we're all seeing. I mean, in terms of where the breaches are happening, more and more cloud environments, right? AWS, Azure, and knowing those environments and understanding how they work. You know, that's where I think back to what you had said earlier about, you know, learning kind of the skills of a sysadmin, right? I think that now applies to the cloud environments. The more you know about AWS as an example and how it works and Kubernetes and Docker and those things is really only going to help you as kind of things evolve, as well as the attacks and how those evolve.
I think one of the biggest things that I agree so much with is, whether it's development or system administration or whatever, it's critical that security people understand what they are dealing with, like the environment. One of the things we've been pushing really hard lately is understanding the business, right? So getting into it and dealing with that. As you do incident response, I used to, right? If you don't understand what the system is that you're looking at, then you have no hope of actually figuring out what happened or knowing whether you have enough information.
Yeah, that's true. Business context is important. You know, I'm sure you see that, Matt, right? Walking into an environment, first thing you're going to do is assess, like, you know, what is their business? What is it that they're, you know, understanding where the data is going and how that's processed and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's vital to being able to, you know, come in and analyze what, you know, may have happened. But yeah, it's important to look at those things before you have an attack, so you're not trying to learn on the fly, because that's tough. Some tough sledding, I guess.
I was going to ask Matt a question. Also, I have to first apologize. I thought we were going to talk about forensics, so I went down to the operating room and I got the background ready. Never mind. I wanted to ask Matt if you've seen much in terms of end user behavior analytics becoming involved in forensics, or are companies not using that facility much?
Yeah, I think it's gaining adoption, and so it's baked into a lot of products now, a lot of services. So a lot of things are looking for, you know, geographic improbabilities. If I'm logged in here at Cincinnati, Ohio right now, and an hour from now, I'm trying to log in from San Francisco, right? I could not make that travel work realistically. Now, sometimes you get down, you know, rabbit holes where somebody has VPN and they're just kind of bouncing through services, you know, it can throw off, you know, the trail a little bit, but, yeah, so that's getting baked in, but, I am seeing more, solutions geared towards identifying anomalous behavior. And, those are definitely important. And, you know, again, if I'm always logging in from Cincinnati, Ohio today, and all of a sudden one day I'm logging in from San Francisco. Maybe I've gone to the RSA conference and it's legitimate, but maybe, just maybe, if I'm not traveling and it's known that I'm not traveling, you know, that's worth looking into at the very least. And so, understanding, you know, and also, you know, again, as an instant responder, it may not be unusual for me to log in the middle of the night to have to investigate something if I get paged out or what have you. But, you know, if it's a contractor working in a developer project and they've got very set hours that they typically work, you know, again, it might be okay, but it might be, you know, suspicious and needs investigated. So, you know, those are definitely kind of important things that you want to be able to look at. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing more and more of things that, you know, are looking for, you know, those kinds of activities.
So where can our listeners find out more about you and all your talks and tools and all the cool stuff you're working on?
Yeah, absolutely. You can follow me on Twitter is probably the best place. Anything I do, I generally am posting out there. My handle is at Circa. That's at C3RKAH. That's an anagram. So for the nice. Smart folks listening in on the podcast, I'm sure they can figure that one out.
Are you on Mastodon yet?
Effort into it.
Are you on Mastodon yet?
You know, I haven't made that switch. I'm hesitant to want to join yet another social media platform. So that's just
fair enough. Fair enough.
it's hard enough for me to keep up, and you know, the two, you know, between Twitter and LinkedIn, that's enough work for me. I'm not trying to create more work for myself by giving myself yet another platform to try to adapt to. But certainly folks, if they can get the name, then they can look me up on LinkedIn as well. Those are generally the two places I share out where I'm going to be, what I'm doing. And so I do a lot of public speaking. I give a lot of talks, a lot of conferences, but I've also done some workshops here and there. The two I mentioned, I've done live versions of those workshops. I also have a password cracking workshop. I haven't actually put that stuff online yet. It kind of requires that was back when everything was in person. And so like I would literally bring my own, virtual lab with me and spin things up on demand and have people SSH in. And then you could literally do all the exercises. And I'm trying to figure out a good way to do that with remote access without, you know, I'm always nervous about standing up cloud stuff myself and then getting a bill and I have to start selling body parts to pay the monthly bill because I didn't realize what's going to happen. So I'm a little leery of that just because, I don't want to bankrupt myself by mistake.
Yeah, it's great. Well, thank you very much, Matt, for coming on the show.
Sure. It's been a pleasure to be here. And thank you very much again for having me. I do appreciate the time and opportunity to come on and talk about incident response and hopefully inspire some folks to consider that as a career option.
Thanks, Matt.
Great to meet you, Matt. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share it with others, subscribe on your favorite podcast listening app, or leave us a rating and review. To catch all the latest from the show, visit our website, sharedsecurity.net, for all show notes and previous episodes. Follow us on Twitter at SharedSec, and join our Reddit community on the Shared Security Show subreddit. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week for another episode of the Shared Security Show.